chapter 12 of adoption. All those that are justified, God vouchsafeth in and for his only Son, Jesus Christ, to make partakers of the grace of adoption, by which they are taken into the number and enjoy the liberties and privileges of the children of God, have his name put upon them, receive the spirit of adoption, have access to the throne of grace with boldness, are enabled to cry, Abba, Father, are pitied, protected, provided for, and chastened by him as by a father, yet never cast off, but sealed to the day of redemption, and inherit the promises as heirs of everlasting salvation. Chapter 12 of the Westminster Confession on Adoption is rather short, consisting of only one section, yet it undoubtedly merits at least a short discussion. The section states that all those who are justified are also made children of God by adoption, and thereby enjoy certain liberties and privileges. Justification, being a judicial act, is entirely external to us. It gives a new standing before God, but it does not affect any subjective change within us. There are, however, certain inevitable concomitants. Justification is always and without exception accompanied by regeneration, adoption, and sanctification. Now, regeneration and sanctification, unlike justification, produce subjective changes in us. They have nothing to do with our objective position before God. Adoption, on the other hand, has reference both to the external relationship of position and to the subjective changes of character. It is a complex concept that includes both factors which occur separately in justification and regeneration. Adoption expresses the truth that now are we the sons of God. The chapter in the Confession lists the factors in sonship. During the past 100 years, as modernism developed, the doctrine of adoption has been slighted by those disloyal ministers who have rejected the infallibility of the Bible. In its place, they have preached a natural and universal fatherhood of God and a natural and universal brotherhood of man. Now, the Scriptures have considerable to say about the fatherhood of God, but they have little or nothing to say about a natural and universal fatherhood. One verse that might be so understood is Paul's use of a quotation from a Stoic poet, "For we are also his offspring." Possibly the poet had some notion of a universal fatherhood, but Paul used the quotation only to stress that God is a spirit and that men were created in God's image. Another verse is Ephesians 3:15, "Of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named." But this family is more reasonably understood as the family of the redeemed than as the human race as a whole. In contrast with these few and doubtful verses, the Scriptures speak many times and clearly of God's fatherhood in relation to a portion of mankind. Of the Pharisees, Jesus said, "Ye are of your father the devil." But he taught his disciples to pray, "Our Father." The most familiar figure of speech by which entrance into the Christian life is described is that of a new birth. Not all men, but some only, are born again, not by their own will, but of God, and thus God gives them authority to become sons of God. Quite evidently, they were not natural-born sons, otherwise they would not have needed to be born again. If men must be born again, those who are not born again are not children of God. The figure of a new birth is appropriate to the new life that then commences. So also is the figure of the resurrection. Men who were dead in sin are raised in Christ to a life they did not previously have. But the Scriptures also describe this change as adoption. Children of another father are adopted by God and become a part of the Christian family. Here, too, the previous conclusion follows. If a man becomes a child of God by adoption, he could not have been a child of God by nature. And for the same reason, it is clear that the Bible does not teach the universal fatherhood of God, nor the universal brotherhood of man. It speaks about sheep and goats, and about a final and irremediable division between them. Adoption brings certain privileges that are denied to those not adopted. First, they receive God's name, and as members of the family can now call God, Abba, Father. They are pitied, protected, and provided for. They are sometimes even chastened by God as a father, yet never cast off, but sealed to the day of redemption and inherit the promises as heirs of salvation. It is comforting to know that the act of adoption cannot be annulled. The new birth can never be undone. The resurrection to newness of life can never be reversed. Later in the confession, this is more fully stated in the chapters on the assurance of salvation and the perseverance of the saints. By rejecting the scriptural position, liberals sometimes put themselves into uncomfortable positions. Their notion of the universal fatherhood of God depends on the unity of the human race. Now, Orthodox Christians believe in the unity of the human race on the basis that all human beings living today are descended from Adam and Eve. But if the modernists wish to say that the opening chapters of Genesis are false, and if the neo-Orthodox existentialize the account and make it a fable of present-day affairs, then how can they be sure that all men are brothers? If they replace the creation of Adam and Eve with an evolutionary mutation from lower animals, how can they know that there was only one mutation? Why could not such an evolutionary event have happened several times? There is just as much evidence that it happened a dozen times as that it happened once. Hence, the unity of mankind is left without support, and so also the fatherhood of God. Of course, there is a deeper perplexity. The modernist notion of a universal fatherhood of God and a universal brotherhood of man is strictly a physical or biological concept. There is nothing spiritual about it. If there were, it would be necessary to conclude that Stalin and Hitler were spiritually related to God in the same way in which Augustine, Luther, and Calvin were. Now, Christians admit that all men are born sinners. Naturally, Stalin and Calvin were brothers. But God adopted and regenerated Calvin. He gave him a new nature. He raised him from spiritual death. The result is, as St. Augustine showed at such length in his City of God, that God's grace broke the natural unity of the human race and founded, in opposition to the world, a city of God. If the modernists still wish to claim spiritual unity with Hitler and Stalin, we don't. We have been adopted into a different family.